This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Giddy hit Austin!
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
It's in the news. Time to make up your mind. Time to choose. But I see nothing to gain and nothing to lose.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Broadcasting weekly from Trinidad World Recording in Fort Worth, Texas, my studio here in Fort Worth. With me here today is Kurt South. How are you doing there, South?
I'm ready to do some frickin' podcasting, man.
We are here, ladies and gentlemen, to offer you some hope, a map of navigation through difficult musical times here. So many ways to listen to your music, so many ways to get your music. Where do you start? Well, Kurt and I are here to offer a compass, a roadmap, if you will, for the music fan and for the musician out there starting a band, writing songs, making demos. We talk indie music, recording, issues confronting the musician, producer of today, getting his music out there.
We are the lighthouse on the coast.
Out in the fog.
For those adrift in the sea of independent music, where do you go? What do you do?
That's right.
I think have some answers.
You know, you look at the Dinosaur Acts, the Eagles, Springsteen, they're out there touring.
Mm-hmm.
Their bed has been made. They're doing fine. They're going to be just fine.
They are.
But for the guy playing for Tips down at the White Elephant starting out, what's his real future hold?
Go
to law school and then figure it out. Well, on the show today, I'm excited about this because we are going to get into various topics here, including some viewer mail. We've been on the air now for several podcasts. Thanks for listening and for writing in. You can always email us at phil@philpritchett.com. So in our first segment, we're going to get in the changing touring game. Kurt and I talk about this quite a bit. Playing your bars, hitting your clubs, you know, hitting your circuit out there, letting people know you exist, sharing your music. But has that changed in the last few years? Kurt and I have some opinions on that. In our second segment, we're going to get into the mailbag. We have been chomping at the bit here in the last few weeks to get in to address some of these emails, some of these comments that you have been so kind to fill us in on. Mailbag, second segment. And in the vault, we're going to get into a classic record. So stick around and see what that's all about. See what's on Phil's iPod in the final segment. But right here at the top, you know, Kurt, I've been touring now since probably about 95, 96, playing Texas a lot, the circuit, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Amarillo, Lubbock, Corpus, Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, Waco, Austin, Nacogdoches, and round and round and round we go.
The chicken fried steak circuit.
The chicken fried steak circuit. You always stop at the check stop in West Texas, whether you need to stop or not.
You do.
If you have a full tank of gas and a full stomach, you still stop there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been known to time it to where it is a good place to fill up for gas, lunch. It's all timed around where the check stop will fall on our trip.
And you will likely see other musicians.
We should do a – likely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Likely we'll do another podcast, a whole episode from the check stop maybe. such a centerpiece in Phil Pritchett and so many other bands touring cycle.
In one stop at the check stop, I ran into Bruce Robison and Chris Masterson from Sunbolt.
Is
one
that
stop.
Right? Yeah, just stop. Hanging out in there?
Just hanging out.
Oh, man, one time we stopped at the check stop, and the great David Garza was there.
Really?
From David's a great musician. He was in Twang Twang Shakaboom, a great Austin band.
Kinda Twang when I got, can kill you.
Twang can kill you. Just, you know, that rhythmic, you know, a lot of my early Katarina Maria, that kind of stuff, was really based on kind of that Twang Twang Latin-infused sound. And David was there, man, and I just went up to him. I couldn't help myself, dude, and I just beat him mercilessly. I mean, and the guys in the band had never seen me really just jump all over somebody. You know, like, hey, man, there's Lyle Lovett over there. I kind of, yeah, whatever. You know, hey, there's Keen. I kind of shrug and walk off. David comes walking out with his kolaches. I just beat him, man. Just, hey, David, oh, my gosh, what's going on, dude? He just, he kind of looks scared, you know.
Did he dial 911 on his cell phone?
I don't think so, but... Like, man, you should come see you guys in Twang, man. You know, back in Austin. Yeah, man, that's pretty cool. I mean, I was that guy, dude.
It's his life force just drained.
Yeah, he was trying to get to his car. He's like, cool, man. Yeah, really good to see you. No, he's very nice. And but the check stop, man, a centerpiece for touring. I have found, at least I'm speaking for myself here, and I wonder how you have to opine on this. When I got going, you had to show up in these towns, I felt like, once a month or so. Man, you had to roll into Lubbock. You had to roll into Nacogdoches, Waco, about every 4 or 5 weeks just to jump on the stage, to move some CDs around and let people know you exist, sell some CDs out of the back of the van. So that's what we did, you know, to build your audience.
Mm-hmm.
You felt like between shows in a certain market, there was nowhere for them to go. Talking about David, yeah, I was on his mailing list, but that just meant I got a postcard in the mail.
Right.
For about, you know, I just get a little postcard. Hey, we're playing next week, or here's a few dates coming up. But I was in college. I moved every semester your address. I'd get off the list. I'd have to get back on. There was no news on David Garza, Twang Twang Shakaboom, or Soul Hat, these bands I went to go see when I was starting out. No news. There was nowhere to go. There was no internet. Occasionally got an article in the paper. The great Banana Blender Surprise sent out a gigantic newsletter about once every 3 or 4 months, which was very entertaining. I was on their list. Great band to check out, Banana Blender Surprise. So you felt like you had to stay on the road. I felt like really since the dawn of the internet explosion, you know, Napster, et cetera, really, after about 2000. As we continued to do that same deal, I felt like we were playing maybe too much in these markets.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd show up in Lubbock, you know, in September, and we'd have a good crowd. Then we'd show up in October, and, you know, there were other bands. And at least from my perspective, especially in the last few years, we've really backed off and just started playing maybe once or twice a year, 2 or 3 times a year in a certain market. And it seems to always have a good show.
Mm-hmm.
But that's changed drastically from years before.
I think a lot of that is part and parcel of the fact that there are more bands on the road now than there ever have been. And I've read a lot of articles online recently interviewing nationwide concert promoters who are saying that, man, there's so many bands trying to tour right now, and a lot of them share the same fan base. You know, it's like in Texas.
Yeah, that's right.
Blue Edmondson, Wade Bowen, Randy Rogers, all those guys kind of have the same fan base. And if a different one of them is rolling through town every night of the week, at some point the crowd's going to be spread thin. I mean, these people can't go out every single night of the week.
Nor
can they afford
night.
To, you know.
That's right.
And that's true nationwide in all genres of music. And that, you know, if a band rolls into Philadelphia and they only have 15 people show up to see them play, that doesn't mean they don't have a lot of fans, people who buy their albums and keep up with them in that market. It just means on that night, those people couldn't get out to see them maybe.
That's right.
Or maybe someone else had been in town the night before, a lot of people wanted to see them. It's kind of a crapshoot that way. And that being said, I just don't know that touring, you know, just physically showing up in all these different towns is as necessary as it used to be. It used to be that was the only way you spread your music.
That's right. Just to get anyone to buy a CD or be exposed to your music,
right.
You felt like you had to sell 10 or 15 out of the back of the van after a show.
Right.
Now, of course, you play a show, and your people show up. And in the meantime, between shows, they can contact you. They can get some music. They can read the blogs.
If they want to see you live, they can go to YouTube and watch you live on a video.
Yeah, even though it's not the same, there is a way for them to stay connected with the group.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I would go see David in Austin, and then he'd walk off the stage, and I wouldn't know where his next show was unless I saw it in the paper.
Right.
I wouldn't know when his new record was coming out unless there was a review in the paper. There was nowhere to get your news about a specific band you like. And boy, I mean, then I'd get the newsletter, a little postcard, you know, some sort of little notification, you know, from the front. And, you know, when I started my band, that's how we did. We had a, you know, in like the mid-90s, you had a mailing list. We had people signing up. But, I mean, it cost me a fortune, man. We had to print, like, you know, 1,000 postcards and lick the stamps. I mean, for every damn one of those.
What a beating.
Put the labels on there. Half of them came back because they were college kids that moved around. You know, it was all this bulk mail. I was knee-deep in those things at all times. Some of these bands today that come out really take it for granted that you can just do a quick little Twitter or something like that and, you know, just tweet your next show, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very convenient thing. Even just email. I mean, it's free and easy, and you're not beating anyone down. Everyone can unsubscribe. It's not junk mail. It's not.
Right.
But I feel that way. I did feel like, you know, and also in the early aughts, you did have so many more bands, you know, starting to come out and play.
You did.
And sharing the audience. And, you know, we would show up in Houston, and you look on the marquee, and, oh, man, you know, Thursday night we had Bolin, Friday night we had Randy Rogers, Saturday night we have you, Phil. I'm just like, man, you know, I mean, now, you know, we got our fans who'd only come to see us, and they'd always show up. But there's no denying the fact that some of those people had probably been at those other shows the night before, and that starts to get pretty tough.
Sure. It gets expensive.
Well, in the way that we, I think you combat that is you can't go more.
Right.
You have to pull back a little bit.
Yeah.
And just, and hope and trust and say, well, we haven't been there in 2 or 3, 4 months.
Yeah.
Are people going to, they're not going to miss the show. And you're able with the internet to advertise that and say, hey, we're going to be there in 2 weeks, 1 week. Tomorrow night.
This is going to be one of two shows this year.
$10, CD release. Don't miss it. And it's not really unlike Springsteen or the big guys. You know, they couldn't come to Dallas every couple of months.
Yeah.
But so you've got to space it out a little bit. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're adding value to the show when there's fewer of them. You know, it's simple economic. It's scarcity economics. We're only playing twice in Houston this year as opposed to 8 times. So you're kind of giving people an incentive to go one of those 2 times. And you're also kind of pulling yourself out of the mix a little bit, separating yourself a little bit from the rest of the crowd. Because, man, you drive up and down 35 on a Thursday or a Sunday, and all you see are vans and tour buses with trailers behind them.
Yeah, that's right.
Everybody's in a freaking band now.
Yeah.
And that's great. That's great. There's you know, obviously a vibrant music scene going on. There are people out there trying to get heard and whatnot. But especially for a guy like you or myself who's been doing it for a while, man, we're just as liable to get buried by the masses as anyone else is.
Oh, no doubt.
And, yeah, I think just by doing that, I've kind of adopted an attitude of the internet does majority of my touring for me. And I would venture to say that most of the people who buy my music and are quote-unquote fans of mine have never even seen me live.
Yeah, I find that more to be true, too. I mean,
I sell most of my music online. A vast majority of it is purchased by people outside the state of Texas.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Most of those people have not yet had the chance to see me live. Now, there are some markets in the country that I will go hit once or twice a year that are way outside of the state. But the reason I go there is because I know that there's already demand there for me.
The sympathetic audience awaits.
I know that they want to see me. I know I'm not going to show up and play for the door and 12 people are going to be there and I'm going to make $78 and I'm 1,800 miles from home.
Wow.
But it used to be we would do that. We would drive anywhere and everywhere just to get the gig. Well,
it used to be the audience was more built in, and that's still true to some in some cases. you know, even some of these places we've played for a long time, like the Firehouse in Houston, the I'm thinking like the Surf Club in Corpus.
Woody's in Fort Worth.
Woody's, yeah, Port Davis way. Pub in Dallas, at the old Greenville location. These were places that you had your fans, but the tickets were low enough, the cover was low enough. It was kind of a hangout.
Sure.
People kind of just went there anyway, Friday, Saturday night. Yeah, maybe it was $5-6. People just kind of went there, but as the touring stepped up and these bands would just roll through and roll through and roll through, and the ticket prices went from $5 to like $10, $12, $15.
Yep.
Well, you're not playing for a built-in crowd.
No.
You either have fans or you don't. I mean, people aren't just going to walk in for $10. That's what we started running into, and you feel like, man, we can't come here every 5 weeks and expect everybody to show all our 300 people to show up with $10. We got to space this out or we're going to get our clock cleaned a few times.
Well, the local and regional live music has become more akin to a movie experience.
I think that's right.
People
just
don't drive past a movie theater and go, "Hey, let's go see Shrek 3.
It sure is good.
It's only $10. They only go in because they want to see the movie, and they're only going to pay because they want to see it. And that's how it is for bands now. If you're going to put $8 or $10 on the door, you know, just guys wanting to watch the Mavericks game and have a couple beers are not going to stumble in and pay $10.
Yeah.
And then, oh yeah, this band's playing. It's only people who want to see you.
It's so paramount that these times when you do play, and I found this to be truer and truer. Yeah, I used to just, you know, when you're starting out, you show up anywhere that'll pay you and just try to get ahead. So, well, some people will be there. And what you start running into is you do get those guys driving like 5 hours to go to a show. And so, man, if it's not a show you want people to go to, then maybe you shouldn't be playing it.
Right.
You've got to hold out. I mean, it's harder for us to play like maybe the Granada Theater or House of Blues in Dallas, but they're less frequent, but it's a good experience for our fans.
And right.
We get a lot of positive feedback. It'd be easy for us to go and play the Granada, and then a couple weeks later we kind of go in there and just play in some pub somewhere for a small cover, and everybody makes a little money. But it just it starts to water it down, and then your next Granada just isn't going to be as good.
Right, absolutely.
Well, that's some the changing touring game. It used to be you had to physically be out there, but now it seems like if you do exist online in a good fashion, you can spread those shows out a little bit more and hopefully get more bang for your buck as an artist and for you, the fan, with each show. Some touring talk there. Well, getting up here into our next segment, we're going to delve into the ever-expanding mailbag. Thanks for emailing us, phil@philpritchett.com. Let us know your comments. We'll get into your comments in the mailbag next.
Just want to find my own way. Be happy with where I go. The high speed chase that ended with a bluff. All the celebutants are strutting their stuff. If this is the news, please, I've had enough.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast from Trinidad World Recording, my recording studio here in Fort Worth, Texas. With me is my good friend and fellow singer-songwriter, Kurt South. How you doing, South?
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
We've been doing these podcasts for a little while now. We have encouraged all of you listening out there on Radio Free Texas and philpritchett.com, the world and elsewhere, to freely email us your thoughts, questions, comments, complaints. And we've had some stuff. Thanks for sending it in. We're going to get to a couple of those. One of the interesting ones that Kurt received was dealt with our view towards some female artists.
Yes.
Who was that, a fan of yours?
Kat is her name. I believe she hails from North Carolina.
Kat in North Carolina.
She
wants
emailed
to know.
Me and said that she hadn't really heard us discuss female artists that we like.
Are we misogynists? What are we?
I don't know. And that got me thinking. I thought that's
it
a very good point.
Very good point. Very true.
Very good email. And she just wanted us to expand on
talk about
female artists
that are on the iPod, the stuff we listen to.
Yes.
Well, you want to go first on this? You want to throw a couple names out there or what?
Yeah, a couple names that kind of crossed my mind. One of them being Patty Griffin.
Yes, Patty Griffin. She lives in Austin, right?
She does.
Always has or does now?
I want to say she's from the Northeast somewhere, but has been in Austin for a long time now. Yeah.
Oh, man.
She's one who, just as far as female singer-songwriters go, she might be the benchmark.
It's funny how a morning turns the love to shame. Disguised and disfigured, and you thought I tasted like rain.
Letterman's a big fan. I've seen her on Letterman several times.
Yeah, she's been on there several times. I've also seen her on Conan, I believe.
Yeah, AAA darling.
Yeah. Her last record, I believe, was called Children Running Through.
Yeah.
It's funny because a lot of weddings I'm asked to play Heavenly Day,
which is a
Patty Griffin song. People are like, hey, you know that Patty Griffin song? It's kind of become a staple for all of you getting married.
Well, she's one of those voices when you hear it, there's no denying it.
No question it's her.
Much like we talked about the Mark Knopfler guitar playing, the Patty Griffin voice is also
absolutely
just undeniable.
She has just an otherworldly, angelic voice and writes great songs.
Right.
And her voice is an instrument in and of itself, unlike
it
many people.
And really cuts the stuff. She doesn't have it's not a high-pitchy voice.
No.
It's a strong,
kind of whiskey-soaked voice, almost.
Yeah,
real,
but not throaty. It's got a great tone to it.
Yeah,
it
really does.
It's one of those things that it's hard to put your finger on. It really it cuts through, but it's got a warmth to it. It's not shrill in any way.
It's not Mariah Carey, Melissa.
No. Yeah, no. Some female singers you think of that, and then you kind of got the smoky voice singers.
Right, right.
She does that, I guess, when she sings at a lower, softer register. She does have sort of that smoky low voice, but she can get up there and really cut like a good rock singer, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, she's had her songs covered by myriad artists. Dixie Chicks have recorded her songs, and
right.
You know, she's one of those people has a very strong touring fan base too. I mean, people love to go see her.
Right.
She's been a successful artist for years now. It's been a long time, but she's one that. The first one that comes to mind. And you, I believe, Amy Mann is one of yours.
Yeah, I'm a huge... I take a lot of grief at times for my my admiration of Amy Mann.
Something isn't right, I don't know how I know, but maybe it's despite your dog and pony show.
For those of you who may not be that familiar with her, she's a singer-songwriter. She was in a band called Till Tuesday way back in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Voices carry.
Oh,
that song?
Shush.
Keep it down now.
Voices carry. Little podcast sing-along there, people.
Oh, shush. Keep it down now. But that was Amy Mann, her first band. Of course, that disbanded in the 80s, and she was just thrown on the scrap heap of MTV 80s history. Well, She resurfaced in the 90s as this eclectic songwriter,
mm-hmm.
you know, very, very, you know, pretty girl.
Sean Penn's sister-in-law.
Yes, Sean Penn's sister, married to the great Michael Penn, who
great.
I know you're a huge fan
man.
Of, as I am.
Yes.
A Beatlish songwriter, brother of Sean, God, what was a Michael Penn song?
Oh, that entire March
what
album.
What if I were Romeo?
Yeah, No Myth.
And Black Jean. No, yeah, No Myth.
Yeah, the Bedlam
She's
Boys.
Just looking for someone.
Yeah, that
to
album.
Dance
that with. Album came out my sophomore. No, my freshman year of high school.
Yeah.
And that one song, No Myth, was a huge MTV and radio hit.
Right.
And that was really his only brush with mainstream fame that he's ever had. But man,
because he produced his own stuff. I don't know if he produced that record.
Yeah, he did. That record was actually just a collection of demos.
Oh, that's
that
right.
He,
I remember
that he
that.
Used for a record label, and they said, "Okay, we're just going to put out your demos."
But man, he was no. What I always liked about his production, and he produced some of his Amy Mann records. I love so much.
Also produced a lot of produced Liz Phair album.
Oh, is that right?
Back in the late
Exile
90s,
in Guyville. Yeah. Did you do that one?
I can't remember which one it was.
Oh,
I know it
man.
Was.
Man, that's a great record.
Yeah.
There's a girl for you, Liz Phair. We can talk about
Phair,
her as well.
Yeah, she's cool.
Yeah, but Amy Mann, Michael Penn produced her stuff. Also, I think John Bryan did some of her stuff like that.
Yes.
Man, really great sound. If you want to start out with Amy Mann, of course, she did the Magnolia soundtrack.
Right, right.
Which really brought her into the public consciousness. She did a record called Bachelor Number 2
mm-hmm.
that... Oh, what's the guy's name who made Magnolia? Thomas, say C. Thomas Howe, but that's not it.
No.
Anyway. But he made Magnolia, John C. Reilly and Tom Cruise film. The songs were on there. Save me if you can save me is a great song that was on there. But the great Amy Mann record is The Forgotten Arm.
Yes, her most recent, or was
it
two
was,
albums ago?
A few years back.
It's like 04, 05. Maybe.
Yeah, she's like a boxer.
Yeah.
She's kind of this tough chick kind of thing. And sings really deep voice, and is just really soulful, and she just has all those great Beatle accoutrements, real analog processed, mm-hmm. produced records. Big fat drum sounds, Wurlitzers, organs, all the stuff I love. And her recent record called Smilers
mm-hmm.
has a song called Freeway on there. And Little Tornado, some really great stuff.
I think Little Tornado on my iPod last week.
Yeah.
Yes.
Make it go faster, great stuff.
Good stuff.
So I really think even the most ardent Texas music kind of fan would dig Amy Mann.
Definitely.
Forgotten Arm.
Definitely.
I mean, it is just
so.
Acoustic singing and Goodbye Caroline, King of the Jailhouse, Going Through the Motions. Those are all really, really cool songs. So she's kind of my rocker chick of preference here.
She's
in
your
last
top
several
five,
years.
Probably. You bring her up an awful lot in conversation.
Well, it kind of goes without saying, I feel like it's so ubiquitous now. But I was made aware of Amy Winehouse early on.
Yeah.
And that blew me away, man. That album she
was
did.
Insane.
I remember driving to a show with the full band, Stu and Blue, and we had Mikey Wynn was on the road with us.
Yeah.
Mikey Wynn, always talking about... the greatness of Blind Blake and Woody Guthrie. He didn't listen
Grandpa
to the radio.
Grandpa Jones.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Mikey's just got. He just goes, man, music today has got nothing, man, like the soul it used to have. And he's just he's a poet of the age, a seer of the past, Mikey Wynn.
Yes,
but that first Amy Winehouse single came on. I'd heard it a few times and was like, oh man, check this out. I treated myself. That I'm no good. And man, we were all just like, dude, that is just fantastic. That whole album was great,
man.
Rehab and I'll watch some of the other ones on there. It's not that old.
It has the greatness of the Dap Kings, which they're the longtime backing band of Sharon Jones, who's a legendary soul singer from
New
York.
Yeah.
And the Dap Kings are produced by Mark Ronson.
Oh, is that right?
Mark Ronson produced that album. Who's
interesting?
Samantha Ronson, Lindsay Lohan's girlfriend's brother, stepson.
6 degrees of separation.
Stepson of the great Mick Ralphs of Bad Company.
Any relation to the great Mick Ronson, David Bowie's guitar player? No?
I don't know.
Maybe. I'll bet she's related to him. What do you want to bet?
Probably.
Ronson, he was on the Dylan tour.
Probably so.
The Review and played guitar as Ziggy Stardust.
I first heard that album.
Which one?
The Amy Winehouse album.
Yeah.
Brian Gaetis, former P2 road manager.
Yeah, you know, he was around in those. I think that's where he got it. He was in the band at that time.
We were on our way back from some ill-fated gigs in Alabama. And we stopped off at some music store right off Interstate 20. And he goes, I have to go in and get something.
Yeah.
I'm like, what are you?
Bought Amy Winehouse.
He just comes out with Amy Winehouse, puts it in the player. And it was on, man. That was such a great album. Yeah. One of my favorites, my favorite female country singer ever is Patti Loveless.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And you know, man, I'm not a huge traditional country music fan, I guess. I mean, I just didn't grow up listening to a lot of country music
stuff
like that. But, man, ever since I heard her when I was in junior high, I've loved everything she's done. She just has this incredible voice, always chose great songs.
Yeah.
Had a lot of great duets with Vince Gill, stuff like that. But, I mean, if I want to listen to country music, I go and put Patti Loveless on.
Yeah.
Still to this day, the other day I was... everyone had gone to bed at home, and I wanted to surf the internet and listen to some good country music. I put on Patti Loveless and just listened to about 20 of her songs right in a row. Every one of them was great.
Yeah.
So there's another one that
of course it goes without saying. There's some of course Emmylou Harris. You know, we've got all her vinyl over here in the studio.
Oh yeah.
Luxury Liner and
Soldier to Birmingham, great song.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know,
Two More Bottles of Wine, doing the great Delbert McClinton tune. She has a ton. You know, Red Dirt Girl is a great record.
Yeah,
Daniel Lanois produced. He produced that one. Red Dirt. That's what I'm thinking of, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe that's right.
The little atmospheric one with the pedal steel on it and stuff like that.
Yeah,
Emmylou, of course, great. So there you go, Amy Winehouse,
Patti Loveless, Patty Griffin,
man, couple Amys.
If your name is Patty, you're probably pretty good, apparently, from what we've discussed.
No question about it. Well, let's get to another letter here. J.R. Smith, it simply says here, it was something, I'm paraphrasing here. It's on the computer in the other room. He wanted to know why he went to see my band play, Phil Pritchett and the Full Band, on a hot August afternoon, and saw me on stage wearing jeans, boots, a black shirt, and a denim jacket. In 100-degree heat. I thought that was a good question.
It is a good question. Explain.
Well, that's a tough one to answer. The great Pete Coatney, Jack Ingram's longtime drummer and a good friend of mine. He's always been sort of like a big brother to me of sorts in this industry. Pete, great family man, great drummer. And always dressed, no matter what the weather was, he just had on the leather jacket, the jeans, the long pants, the sunglasses. He looked like he was ready to go play a show. Mm-hmm. It might be Sunday afternoon in May or something. And one time I did pose the question to him. I said, man, I was young, starting out. Aren't you hot? Jeez, what are you wearing all this heavy stuff for? He just kind of shrugs and says, you know, to be cool, you got to be willing to be a little hot, you know, and he kind of laughed. But... And so I thought it was a joke. He said, well, seriously, he said, do you think Stevie Ray Vaughan ever wore shorts? And that gave me great pause. Did Johnny Cash ever wear a tank top, you know, in Tevas? You know, I guess I never really thought about it before. Of course, he said, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan, back in the day, if he was going to the pawn shop or to play some guitars at the music store, and it was 110 degrees, what would he wear? And I'm like... Man, probably a full-length snakeskin
duster
and a with a serape under it and a hat. Yeah, he said, yeah, he wouldn't just put on his swimming trunks and walk in barefoot. The point he was trying to make is that Yeah, I don't know. And so I've never been a big fashion horse to begin with. Guys picking out shirts and stuff. So the day after Johnny Cash died, I just said I wore a black shirt, you know, just for while I was playing my shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pleased to find I didn't have to think about what I was going to wear at the shows. I had a bunch of black shirts. I just said, I'll just wear a black shirt. Big deal. But there was a lot of issues early on with the band on what we were going to wear on stage. And, man, you're wearing that shirt, dude. You can't wear that. That's stupid, you know. So this takes all that out of the equation. I just said, man, I'm just going to wear a black shirt when I play. You know, jeans and boots, which I've always worn. And if it's, you know, under like 105 degrees, I am going to wear a light jacket on stage most of the time.
And you look good.
Well, it's just, I don't have to think about it. I don't have to think about how I look.
Yeah.
I just put it on. And there's a great quote from I gave the book On the Road with Bob Dylan to Zach Huckabee, who's a big Bob Dylan fan.
Mm-hmm.
Zach's from Lampasas. He came in here. I'm producing his new record here. Big Dylan fan. He never read that book. It's a great book. It was written by Ratso Sloman, who is a reporter for Rolling Stone. And there's a great scene in there where Ratso's trying to report on the tour. This is during the Rolling Thunder review tour of, like, you know, 1974.
Yeah.
Dylan, when he was painting his face white, you know, and all this kind of bizarre stuff. So they go to, they're in a bar, and Dylan's, like, drinking by the jukebox. He's wearing he said, I notice Bob's at the jukebox, and someone comes in and says, hey, everybody, back to the hotel. We all got to get on the bus to go to the next show. It's short notice. Let's go. So everyone starts scrambling around. The band, the crew gets up. Everybody's running out trying to get cabs to get back to the hotel. Well, Dylan just stands there just drinking and playing the jukebox. Sloman goes over and says, hey, Bob, don't you need to get to the hotel? And Dylan's like, what for? He's like, well, you know, get all your stuff. And Dylan just looks at him and goes, I don't have any stuff. And then Sloman goes, and then I realize he's wearing just a, you know, a button down pearl snap kind of shirt, plaid shirt, jeans, boots, this, you know, big gray cowboy hat kind of fedora thing he was wearing in those days, and a leather jacket. And he said, man, that's what he wore at the gig. That's what he wore in the morning. That's just what he wore all day long. He wasn't like changing clothes. He didn't have any stuff. He was ready to go. And I think, I've taken some of these things to heart. I do my laundry. I don't wear it for the same days in a row. But as far as just getting up and knowing what you're going to put on, it takes a load off my mind, South.
Well, it's like Billy Joe Shaver always has on an old pair of Wranglers, a blue denim Wrangler work shirt.
Yeah, denim shirt, right.
Same belt, same boots, that's it. And I'll admit, I've been wearing this shirt for 3 days now.
Is that right? Well, it looks great.
Yeah, well, the thing about this shirt is I'm a hard guy to fit clothes on.
Yeah.
I'm tall. I have really long arms.
Yes.
And it's just
you are a bit gangly,
Yeah, you know, and in the past, I would have to get shirts tailored. You know, my mom would always go get them custom fitted for me.
Well, you take your $3 pearl snaps in there for a custom fitting?
Well, that's one reason why I like the Wrangler pearl snaps is I can get the exact fit. But then this shirt, just a regular button-down Oxford shirt that I've got on, I found it. It fits perfectly, and I don't want to take it off. And I'm on day three. The lady at the bank has said something about it. It's like, weren't you wearing that? And I was like, yes, ma'am, I was. And I'll probably be wearing it tomorrow when you see me to withdraw $4 from my account.
To get you through the day. My father, the great Phil Pritchett Sr., was noted. He always wears the white Oxford button-down, jeans, and boots.
I've seen him in that uniform.
He varies, but that's just kind of – that's what he wore when he was 30, when he had his kids, and that's what he wears now. And so when you see pictures of him, he looks the same. He's wearing the same. You know, whereas the women and the men who went through the whole, you know, floral print shirts and the sideburns and all that, they look dated. They look a little silly. So there's something to be said for that. When you do see the photos of Johnny Cash, of Dylan, just kind of wearing their denim – and their leather jackets, it holds up over time. So why should we aspire? Why should we aspire to be anything less, South?
Just stick with the classics, people. Stay away from the skinny peg jeans, guys.
Yeah.
Don't wear your girlfriend's jeans. And, you know, stay away from all the leather wristbands and the T-shirts with skulls on them.
That's
and
right.
Eagles. Because 2 years from now, you will look back at a picture and you'll look
You've said this on the show many times. Yeah.
And you will look ridiculous.
Well, that is some fashion talk from the mailbag, asking about why we dress the way we do. Some female artists that we admire, we threw some out there. Well, coming up in the vault, oh, I can't wait to get into this. We're going to go into, we've done a few classic records lately. This artist fits into a category that is he shouldn't be proud of, but he should be proud of this record. We'll get into that next. Fans, Romans, countrymen, welcome back. Phil Pritchard here. My good friend Kurt South is on hand. We get to the final part of our show here where we love to take an album, one of my records, a friend of ours' records, and talk about why we have them, why they are worth the precious digital space in your iPod. Well, today we're going to look at a classic record. Something maybe some of you have owned on 8-track tape, vinyl, CD, in MP3 format. Or perhaps not. It's a record I find shockingly. A lot of young Texas music kind of guys come in here, and they see this record in the vinyl rack, and they get a puzzled, confused look on their face. And they cast an eye toward me with judgment, like, God, why would you have one of these guys' albums over here? Well, the truth is I have a lot of these guys' records. I'm talking about the great Rod Stewart. Now, hold on there. Now, hold on.
What are you talking about? Rod Stewart?
Rod Stewart. You know what I'm talking about.
Is he wearing a tuxedo singing some stuff?
Rod Stewart.
No, I know what you're talking about. This
Kurt
is
knows
a
exactly what I'm talking about.
It's a classic.
He's being a little facetious there. Rod Stewart, before he was doing disco in pink leather pants. You know, if you want my money and you think I'm sexy, come. He was really the face of disco.
He was.
Of classic rock guys gone disco.
Yeah.
We've talked about how disco ruined so many great bands.
Yes.
But the truth is all these guys had a past life. So that is the category Rod should not be proud to be in. Now he's singing the American Songbook. It just gets worse from here on.
He's just singing Gershwin in a tuxedo.
Singing Gershwin, crooning. But let me tell you what. Back in this early 70s, Rod Stewart could do no wrong. Gasoline Alley, great record. He was in the Faces, of course, with Ian McClagan, Ronnie Wood, Kenny Jones, the great British. I mean, you want to talk about a boozy, kicking ass rock and roll British bar band and an incredible rock singer, Rod Stewart. Well, he was kind of a sideman. He did some singing with Jeff Beck. He did some stuff with the Faces. He was kind of a good-looking frontman kind of guy. A hell of a soccer player, Rod Stewart.
Yes, he was. Professional soccer player in
Professional
Scotland.
Soccer player, that's right.
Yeah.
I've seen some footage of him where he's out there. Just Rod Stewart, Rod Stewart shotgun! He's just running down the pitch. When he was on tour a few years back, my sister was coming out of her high school. It had been raining for like 2 weeks. And Stewart was in town, and she walked out. She looked out on the soccer field of the high school, and there's Rod Stewart out there, just like juggling, just a soccer ball on his knees. And everyone's like, "Dude, this is Rod Stewart!" And all the kids go over there. He just plays a little pickup game of soccer.
Really?
This was probably like mid '90s, he'd been cooped up with all the rain for a few days, and he was like, "Oh, you know, it was a nice day. I thought I'd come out and play some football, you know." But let me tell you what, man. Every picture tells a story. I think it was his third record, I think. Every picture tells a story. Starts off with just that haunting little plucking minstrel renaissance. Right before it just busts into the all-time great Maggie May.
Wake up, Maggie. I think I got something to say to you. It's late September and I really should be back at school. Amused, but I feel I'm being used. Oh, Maggie, I could
wake up, Maggie, I think I got some. Of course, I mean, just a ubiquitous rock and roll staple.
My wife's favorite song.
Is that right?
Yes.
And man, the tracks are so cool on this whole album.
Yeah.
The whole sound of that track, when it comes on the radio, and the drums just banging away, and guitars just clanking. Guy got Ron Wood playing guitar all over this. The great Ron Wood, who would later go on to join the Rolling Stones, of course. You know, I met Ron Wood one night.
I can't believe I haven't heard this story.
I can't believe I heard the story either.
I cannot.
Ronnie Wood. You know, Mike Myers did the impression of him on Saturday Night
Yes,
Live.
Yes.
With the martini glass and the cigarette. Just, whoa, baby, you know, he just like falls off the stage. Well, man, I was visiting my good friend James Hadaway, who was a counselor with me at the camp in Colorado. This was probably, you know, 93, 4. And I was in Georgetown, Southwestern University. James was at school in Austin at UT. So I went down to hang out with him one night. So we hit 6th Street. We hit it pretty hard, man. We were hitting all the stops. And I had read that Ron Wood of the Rolling Stones, guitar player for the Rolling Stones, was in town doing like a solo show in some little place. And he had he's a great artist. You've seen all his drawings.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
Clapton Crossroads sketch. And he's just a phenomenal drawer, painter. And he also had an art tour kind of going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we were on 6th Street, and there's some little bar there, and people were coming out going, hey, man, Ron Wood's in there. Rolling Stones, man. Rolling Stones. Well, I'd had a couple of beers, so I was brave. I could do I'm going in there and meet Woody, man. The
Drunk
Stones.
Phil
the
assaulting
Stones.
Ron Wood.
Yeah. So we go in there, and I'm kind of looking around the place, and man, I just turn to the left, and just, man, it's just like right out of the Saturday Night Live sketch. There's Wood, man, with the rooster hair, the cigarette in each hand. Just wine glasses and martini glasses littering the table. You know, a beautiful woman on either side of him, and these two huge, you know, look like Vin Diesel kind of the Rock type bodyguard dudes, just with their arms folded. Like, he was in a corner booth, just kind of sitting there looking at the crowd, you know, and a couple of people were kind of talking about it. But he wasn't being mobbed or anything. So I go walking over there, and these two guys just move over and go, come on, man, what are you doing now? I'm like, hey, come on, Woody. Hey. And I had a back of a business card and a pen. You know, I was like, I just wanted to get Ron Wood's autograph. That's all right. Like, come on, Mike. Come on, Mike. I'm like, hey, come on, Woody, man. And Wood just looks up and he goes, hey, Ron Wood. And he grabs my business card. Yeah, he gave me his autograph. Ron Wood.
Really?
Yeah, man. I was like, Woody, I. You know, and they threw us both out. No, not really.
Then
it
you
was
were,
worth it.
Then you were beaten to a bloody pulp.
But it was
one
of those deals, man, where, you know, you go out late, you know, you don't get a lot of sleep. And you wake up the next morning and you're kind of driving back to I was driving back to school and just kind of remembered, oh, man, I met Ron Wood. It was like 2 in the morning.
Did I really meet
the
Ron
Rolling
Wood?
Stones. Yeah, just look at the autograph there. And there it was, you know. And fantastic, man, Ronnie Wood. So he's on this record. Oh, man, Reason to Believe. Still I look to find a reason to believe. Man, a great soul singer, Rod Stewart. And I just loved his whole boozy bravado back in these days.
Well, he was kind of the male sex epitomized.
Yeah, he really
back
was.
Then.
He
mean,
had the
he
scarves.
Was,
he always played his shirt off, you know.
I would venture to say that he kind of was the forerunner of the later glam rock guys who were doing the kind of androgynous.
Oh yeah, I mean he,
deal, man.
Yeah, Iggy Pop's whole look was kind of a Rod Stewart,
right,
really
right.
Based on that.
Yeah,
on that
I mean even
thing.
Steven Tyler from Aerosmith probably stole a
oh no
big,
question
big piece of his.
He
act
was the ultimate.
Rod
he was
Stewart.
The ultimate front man. I
yeah,
mean, really,
he was.
It was almost even before like Mick Jagger really came into his own
yeah,
to a degree.
That's
I
true.
Mean, you know, Jagger in the 60s, you know, he was.
Still
of course, he was the ultimate front man. Mick
still
Jagger.
Wearing a 3-piece suit and stuff.
Yeah,
and,
you know, just playing maracas and kind of jumping around. And,
yeah.
But Stewart, man, he had that rooster strut, man. He had it down. And I've also met Ian McClegan, who was the organist keyboard player on this record in The Faces. And
a great solo artist.
Yeah,
his own
great
right
solo
now.
Artist. Yeah, Ian McClegan in the Bump Band. We played with him at Saxon Pub. And he lives in
really?
Austin now, McClegan.
Well, I was a couple weeks ago. I was driving through Austin. You know, we used to always play that "What's on KGSR" game.
Oh yeah, yeah.
As soon as I turned on KGSR, it was "This is Ian McClegan,
and you're listening to KGSR 107.1."
And I'll be playing at
Saxon Pub.
I'll be at Jovita's next Wednesday night
during the evening brunch.
And then they just played his new single, and it sounded his new solo record sounded, it was just right out of Gasoline Alley or something. It was just that vibe. Was great.
Do you look at these old Stewart records like Gasoline Alley and the one with the whole album shaped like a tumbler of scotch with the ice cubes in it? I got it over there. And just the inside, dude, they're all just like, they all just have like four drinks in their hands,
yeah,
a cigarette between every finger, like sunglasses on, and just, they all just look like they've just been recording and just totally rocking out, man.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. But Rod Stewart, man, don't count him out. Go back and cast off the American Songbook. Cast off, Do You Think I'm Sexy? All that nonsense. Go all the way back to Every Picture Tells a Story. Turn it up. You got Mandolin Wind on there.
Yeah,
a great version of I'm Losing You.
Yeah.
1972. Rod Stewart. Well, that is what's on P2's iPod here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for being here, Kurt.
Hey, it's been
a great episode.
We
had some mailbag talk, touring talk. I'll end it with a little Rod Stewart. We will be back next week for the P2 podcast. Until then, friends, we'll see you soon. Take care.